Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to the second introduction episode of our special series on my PhD thesis. If you're listening right now, that means you signed up to support this show, and for that, thank you so much. It will be my honour, pun intended, to guide you through my Whopper thesis, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what you make of my findings and conclusions. We left our analysis last time by examining how honour was a concept containing two spheres, the personal or gentlemanly sphere and the national sphere. Honour was a flexible enough term to be associated both with the person and the nation, and the Victorian culture was suffused with these sentiments of honour, seen even in the fact that right honourable gentlemen addressed the Houses of Parliament. In this episode, we build upon this analysis and consider the linguistic depths of honour as an idea. What other terms were associated with national honour? How different were these terms to national honour itself? And how did they become intertwined into a broader rhetoric which could be effectively used in a political setting? We follow these questions by examining how national honour has been treated, or ignored altogether, by historians, and we ask what can be learned from those scholars that did take the time to consider this fascinating belief system. Without any further ado, I will now take you to the second part of our thesis's introduction. Introduction. Part 2. A survey of two spheres, personal and national honour, continued. Concepts such as dignity, respect, credit, standing, influence, and prestige all acquired the trappings of honour, while being sufficiently different to distinguish them from national honour itself. While Britain deserved respect from foreign powers, her dignity could be imperiled by contrary treatment, such as disrespecting her flag. British credit was linked to her honour, raising such questions as the payment of national debts above that of mere finance. An honourable nation would discharge such debts even to rival nations, rather than have her credit or good faith implicated. British honour was also affected by the reputation of her power, and the ability to project it, a concept referred to as prestige. Prestige did not merely require proper maintenance of those armed forces, but, as Disraeli insisted, an active foreign policy that saw Britain involved and consulted on major international questions. This is perhaps the most accurate appreciation of the concept that can be gleaned, although prestige's close linkage with honour did not prevent Lord John Russell from asserting that, provided the honour, the character, and the reputation of this country were maintained, I cared very little what became of the prestige of the country. Russell was far from prestige's only critic. Prestige was not Britain's only source of honour. It was also measured by her influence, a concept boasting as many interpretations as honour itself. Palmerston saw influence as that respect which is felt in foreign countries for the English nation, and that promptitude to give redress for injuries, while also ascribing a moral element. Disraeli emphasised moral influence, a position held by a very delicate and refined tenure. He warned that you cannot abuse it, you cannot increase its efficacy by Hudibrastic speeches and grotesque resolutions. Only once well-informed statesmen addressed foreign nations with dignity could Britain retain and exercise that moral influence of which you may well be proud, but when you do exercise it, let it be for the benefit of Europe and the glory and reputation of your country. Nor was this a Disraelian invention. Oded Lovenheim addressed moral influence and credit in his analysis of Britain's decision to destroy the power of the Barbary pirates. On another occasion, Palmerston clarified that influence could be maintained either by hope or by fear. Weak powers should be taught to hope that they will receive the support of this country in their time of danger, while strong powers should be taught to fear that they will be resisted by England in any unjust acts either towards ourselves or towards those who are bound in ties of amity with us. Rejecting Palmerston's more interventionist interpretations, Lord Derby asserted that influence was best maintained and upheld by abstaining sedulously and carefully from interfering in even the slightest degree with the purely domestic concerns of other countries. When he attacked government for its failures in the Schleswig-Holstein question, Disraeli insisted that Britain's just influence had been lowered and damaged in a motion which facilitated a four-day debate. Salisbury distinguished between influence of that material kind which our fathers were wont to value, and that great moral influence with which we are flattering ourselves, and which means our never being able to induce others to do what we want, while still insisting it should be carefully husbanded. It was said that Britain's colonial possessions, above all in India, depended on this prestige and the effective use of influence. Notwithstanding such disagreement, what contemporaries did agree on was that national honour was set on a pedestal uniquely its own. It was prioritised above monetary questions. It was to be defended regardless of the cost, and whether Britain enjoyed foreign support or acted alone. Notwithstanding the establishment of new standards of international law under the Treaty of Paris, 1856, national honour both superseded international law and informed the fulfilment of its tenets. In 1874, Sir Edward Creasy's First Platform of International Law affirmed the national honour as central to this system. Creasy made noteworthy observations on how the receipt of insults could be legally construed as a casus belli, the practical utility of arbitration, and the defence of the flag in language which mirrored that of parliamentarians. Creasy affirmed what contemporaries had already been insisting in Parliament: the code of honour was essential to ensure peace and stability across the world. Some even argued that it had a greater hold on nations than Christian principles. If it was jeopardised or ignored, the entire system could fall apart, a fear which may explain the heightened sensitivity which lent itself to language of angst and hyperbole. Twinned with nostalgia for a period of triumph during the Napoleonic Wars, this rhetoric could be a potent political weapon, even if contemporaries may have been insincere in its deployment. Also palpable from this rhetoric is the close relationship between conceptions of Victorian masculinity and a manliness in foreign policy which statesmen were expected to emulate. Foremost among these statesmen was Palmerston, who, according to an obituary by contemporary journalist Peter Bain, was at all points a man. Palmerston had no sentimental egotism, no moral irritability, no sweet feminine cant about him. He possessed a genial stoicism, and an inestimable faculty of taking the good and leaving the bad alone, an invincible serenity and lightness and brightness of soul distinguished him. He was hopeful in adversity, cool in prosperity, ready for any fate. Gentlemen were expected to conform to those expectations if they wished to be described as manly, and according to John Tosh, the term even displaced more traditional ideas of courtesy and political etiquette. Conversely, a policy perceived as effeminate was linked to dishonour, shame, or humiliation. Thus, when criticising what he perceived as the government's truckling to Russia, Thomas Attwood could declare, "The government has emasculated England." As the Times asserted, "The honour of the English flag is like that of an English woman. It must not be ever so slightly blown upon with impunity or without atonement." Another common expression of honour was its abstract form as a privilege, reward, or tradition. Statesmen were honoured to serve the nation in positions of office, just as they had the honour to correspond with the Queen. The Queen rewarded accomplished gentlemen with honours, normally in the form of titles which enhanced their social status and reputation. But if the Queen was the fountain of honour, Parliament served as its theatre. It was in Parliament that the Right Honourable Gentlemen of both Houses openly contested one another's interpretation of what was due national honour, just as they disputed how it could be best maintained. Honour was the exclusive preserve of members and lords. Interestingly, lawyers and religious figures were ridiculed if they attempted to speak in national honour's name. Whether Whig, Tory, Radical, or Irish, all members of Parliament had to contend with national honour, and it is significant that even as the British political establishment experienced dramatic transformation, its burgeoning political parties deployed national honour in similar ways. Notably, however, these figures could also be inconsistent, opposing an interpretation of national honour in one instance, yet supporting that interpretation when they came into power. That contemporaries were able to declare that black was white and arrive at different conclusions to their opponents suggests not just an inherent cynicism, but also an elasticity in national honour's meaning. This elasticity was reinforced by the varied contemporary expressions on what national honour actually meant. In a letter to the Queen, Lord John Russell argued that the honour of England does not consist in defending every English officer or English subject right or wrong, but in taking care that she does not infringe the rules of justice and that they are not infringed against her. The radical Henry Warburton considered the best foundation of national honour was the obtaining a character for clemency and justice. This emphasis of justice speaks to contemporary literary influences on the concept, such as that of Wordsworth. To William Gladstone, national honour meant neither more nor less than the faithful discharge of the duties of a government. Lord John Russell identified national honour as a jewel which we will not have tarnished, an expression which was later held against him. The radical John Roebuck reflected that the people of England liked that minister and held him to their hearts who maintained the national honour, while warning against the low level of national morality that would bind up all our feelings in the interchange of commodities or the sordid question of profit and loss. Newspapers presented similar arguments but added their own interpretations. National honour was a valuable abstraction, according to the Freeman's Journal, and a nice and delicate point, according to the Fife Herald. There was also room for criticism of the ethic. The Sheffield Iris condemned national honour as a meteor phantom, language which was occasionally echoed in Parliament. According to the Globe's estimation of national honour, an orator may give what quantity and quality of significance he pleases to the abstract idea for the purpose of fitting it to any given state of things. One regional paper believed that national honour is entirely founded on temporal expediency, and the use of a standard of national honour is to check national ambition, selfishness and lawlessness. Importantly, national honour was respected not much for its intrinsic merits, as out of the fear of the consequence following its violation, war, and it is, of all inventions of earth, the most earthy. But were such varied perspectives representative of the national feeling? Sir Robert Peel perhaps captured the dilemma best when he reflected that however important newspapers might be as auxiliaries in supporting and vindicating the honour of their country, yet they were not at all times to be regarded as the exponents of a nation's feelings. Peel's warning notwithstanding, it is true to say that a fear of national honour's tenets persisted, palpable in the anxiety which accompanied any suggestion of national dishonour or shame. Any statesman guilty of this charge would not last long in office. As Uni Wicken argued, it was a fear of being shamed rather than a reverence for their honour that compelled men to act. Indeed, just as the overriding demands of honour make a character do what he, or less often she, does not want to do or would not do according to natural feeling and yet feels obliged to do, so could national honour place statesmen in a difficult position. As Viscount Stratford de Redcliffe lamented on the eve of the Schleswig-Holstein crisis, Britain might be exposed to consequences of the most dangerous and hazardous kind, in which we might find our honour and our interest at variance. Facing this impossible choice, contemporaries were constrained to operate within honour's instructions. It was also difficult to appease honour through more experimental processes such as arbitration. There was a concern that an arbitrating party would not treat the national honour as carefully as Britain would, and were Britons not best equipped to care for their own honour? Some scholars maintain that international law's underdevelopment made arbitration impossible, but it did happen. Perhaps because the results of these efforts were not inspiring, and, as Edward Creasy affirmed, loopholes existed when honour was at stake, opponents felt vindicated in insisting that arbitration should be done away with entirely. As Geoffrey Best posited, although arbitration was in the air, it never got very far because of nationalism's jealousy of its honour. In the context of regular foreign crisis, however, arbitration was a legitimate route for maintaining peace and acquiring a settlement honourable to all parties. After all, as one MP asserted, arbitration was no different to the practice of seconds preventing the duel. Paradoxically, while Britons were squeamish about this risk, they were eager to be seen as arbiters for other powers. Palmerston declared that the best test of whether countries or individuals were properly upholding their honour was when they found other countries or persons applying to them on matters in which their honour also was concerned. When powerful nations accepted Britain's mediation on matters which concerned their honour, this meant that the government had maintained peace without any dereliction of honour, while the respect paid to England by the other nations of the world had gone on increasing instead of diminishing. Nor did Britons hesitate to recommend arbitration to third parties, as in 1866 the Earl of Clarendon believed it would reflect great credit upon Prussia if she accepted arbitration of her dispute with Austria, thus placing Berlin in the hands of seconds upon whose impartiality she could rely and with whom her honour would be in safe keeping. National honour did contain terms and conditions which could mollify its severity. There were occasions where a war for honour's sake was impractical and pragmatism took hold, and rhetorical tools were available to justify this selective application of national honour. Forbearance could enable the country to withstand insults without flying to war, a loophole which the government used to its full effect in 1848, when grappling with the expulsion of its ambassador from Madrid. Yet it was understood that there were limits beyond which magnanimity became folly, subjecting those who passed them to suspicion of want of proper spirit and self-respect. Some scenarios were too devoid of British interests to allow national honour to lead. In 1833, Earl Derby dismissed as chivalrous feelings Thomas Attwood's request for war with Russia in the name of violated treaties. Britain might be obliged to aid its ally, but where that ally insulted a third party, that insulted party had the right to acquire satisfaction without British interference. Across such varied cases, national honour's value was taken for granted. Only very rarely did contemporaries reflect on why or how the concept had acquired such a central precedence in Britain's foreign policy. The rhetoric of honour was thus incredibly varied. It was perhaps required to be so, if it was to be convincingly applied to such abstract questions as military strength, parliamentary reform, or the defence of the flag, to take a few samples. This facilitated a flexibility in rhetoric, where contemporaries would not merely invoke national honour during debate, but would criticise or justify government policy with the ethic in mind. In this manner was the rhetoric of honour harnessed as a political tool, though its potency depended on the circumstances, as the following case studies will demonstrate. Importantly, national honour resonated with the public, supposedly to the point of mobilising the population for war in its defence. Mismanagement of the national honour could threaten the government's tenure in office, and ministers were compelled to defend their record in this regard. Notwithstanding its pervasiveness and occasional utility, it will be contended here that national honour was not a panacea either for the government or the opposition. It might more accurately be described as a double-edged sword, as it facilitated the political attack and defence while constraining those parties within a certain pattern of behaviour. But contemporary statesmen were not alone in making this case. The British press was also a key player, setting the tone of political conversation and providing additional pressure in times of foreign crisis. These sources helped clarify and impress what was at stake to its readership and contributed to the discourse which upheld the ethics tenets as closely linked to British security. However, if the scholar seeks further evidence from secondary sources, they are confronted with a striking gap in the Victorian historiography. This gap and its implications will be addressed next. Part 3. Historiography. In his analysis of the origins of the First World War, honour was identified by James Joel as an unspoken assumption, a cultural or ideological phenomena which was so pervasive it did not need to be discussed, thus relegating it to the background where it is easily missed. However, in Parliament, national honour was firmly in the foreground. A survey of parliamentary debates on Victorian foreign policy reveals a consistent and pressing concern for national honour, expressed in rhetoric which might do damage to the perceived guilty party or enhance the standing of the figures that preserved it. Scholars have only recently begun to consider the extent of national honour's power, its relevance and its function. Although these studies do not address the rhetoric of national honour directly, they do suggest a burgeoning historiography to which this research project will contribute, and which is worth surveying here. Alan Z. Hertz provided one of the most comprehensive assessments of the Code of Honour Among Nations by analysing national honour's development, its application in international relations, and its record over a wide variety of European nations. Jörg Friedrichs elaborated that international relations were based upon a national sense of self-worth. In his consideration of the Foreign Office mind, T.G. Otte presented national honour as a form of soft power, reflective of British financial and political power, and articulated through a wide range of synonyms such as prestige, dignity, and influence. Although he affirmed that Britain's honour and interests were frequently presented as indivisible, Otte dedicated only a few paragraphs to national honour in his conclusion, and did not interrogate how the ethic was used. Other scholars provide a narrower focus. Glenn Melanchon argued that national honour compelled Britain to declare war on China in his study on the First Opium War, though this singular focus on the ethic has been criticised as reductionist. Analyses of the First World War have proved fruitful for measuring national honour's rhetoric and influence. As seen above, Avner Offer also examined honour as a code of conduct on the threshold of war in 1914, concluding on the ethic's understated importance and presenting an important methodological tool which may be deemed an honour script. Although Ute Frevert assessed a similar period, her focus on gender and the language of honour among the belligerent powers in 1914 is particularly prescient for this study. Frevert perceived the dominance of honour in the language that was used to whip up national feelings, remarking that one cannot help noticing how often contemporaries alluded to honour in order to justify what they were thinking and doing. If such observations ring true for 1914, they were equally true in the period before, where incessant crises and confrontations in the European or imperial spheres compelled contemporaries to express their views on what honour prescribed. However, secondary literature on British foreign policy has unfortunately little to say on what national honour was or how it was used. A brief survey of the sources consulted for this research project may reveal these shortcomings. Kenneth Byrne mentioned national honour only in passing and did not attempt to interrogate the ethic any further than its surface appearances during his otherwise landmark study. Keith Wilson discerned a tendency to use a certain decided vocabulary of firm decided language, accompanied by heroic gestures and an opposition to a policy of bounce and bluster as a means of uniting the nation and diverting attention from social issues, yet Wilson did not identify these tactics as arguably subsumed within the rhetoric of national honour. In more specific cases, Wilbur Jones alluded to the ethic during moments of Anglo-American crisis, but did not interrogate the role which national honour played in their relations. Keith Sandiford, in the only survey of its kind on British policy during the Schleswig-Holstein crisis, also referenced the ethic, but did not analyse national honour. David Brown did provide minimal comments on Palmerston's use of national honour, but did not engage with any deeper analysis. Although it is accepted that Disraeli's fondness for prestige influenced his policy, Palmerston's tactic of leveraging national honour in a public space, which Disraeli arguably drew inspiration from, has not been assessed in any meaningful way. Although scant attention has been paid to the role national honour played in the framing of foreign policy, scholars have assessed the rhetoric which accompanied other concepts, such as patriotism, offering an example which may be useful. Jonathan Parry considered public debates on patriotism and how its meaning changed during the 19th century. Mark Hampton examined how an editor of the Manchester Guardian attempted to challenge patriotism's meaning during the Second Boer War. In Arguing About Empire, Martin Thomas and Richard Toy compared imperial policy rhetoric in a landmark study of Anglo-French relations. The focus on public sources in these studies presents useful frameworks which this research project will emulate. It may be contended that Victorian contemporaries regularly argued about national honour, utilising their positions in Parliament or relationships with the media to articulate and press their case. Indeed, just as imperialism and empire were like empty boxes that were continuously being filled up and emptied of their meanings, national honour was sufficiently versatile and ideologically flexible to apply to a wide range of scenarios. Similarly, national honour was influenced by the culture and traditions in which contemporaries lived. Victorian society had inherited cultural ideas shaped by famed statesmen and Renaissance thought, while influential literary works, including Shakespeare, had affirmed honour's position within early modern society. This tradition continued in Sir Walter Scott's novels, which fused romantic notions of chivalry with Victorian standards of ethics and morality. The Victorian value system was influenced by other factors, including a persistent anxiety for the maintenance of the masculine ideal, even as the duel declined. Charlotte Hooper considered the implications of masculinity for what she described as manly states. Marjorie Masterson analysed public rhetoric in her study of a mid-Victorian masculinity, which was affected by the decline of the duel and interpersonal violence. John Tosh, among others, explored this phenomena further in his analysis of the Victorian ideal of masculinity and its role in shaping domestic culture. Angus Hawkins addressed Victorian political culture more broadly by examining the inherent values and public assumptions which underlined the era. While this research project need not explore Victorian masculinity in great detail, these studies help inform the gender nature of national honours rhetoric. Although parliamentary debates are essential to an analysis of this rhetoric, it is also important to recognise the contributions of the Fourth Estate, Britain's print industry. Scholars have devoted special attention to the Victorian newspaper press, discerning spectacular growth after the Crimean War, complemented by the abolition of several taxes that had limited the industry. Services such as reading rooms increased accessibility, and foreign commentators marvelled at Britain's well-informed public. A growing public sphere gave new opportunities for Britons to express themselves and absorb the language of politics. This was accompanied by a stark rise in literacy, increasing accessibility to political debate. Concepts such as liberalism matured in this space, subject to pressures and societal concerns, and enterprising writers introduced more radical ideas, including feminism, though not without controversy. Journals such as the Edinburgh Review, Quarterly Review, and Blackwood's Edinburgh Magazine appealed to educated audiences with regular political commentaries and enjoyed contributions from politicians. A picture emerges of a readership hungry for news, receptive to advertisements, and amenable to political argument as press allegiances shifted. Some papers were identified with politicians, as Lawrence Fenton argued in his analysis of Palmerston's relationship with The Times. Palmerston did not enjoy support from that paper until later in his career, and Fenton also assessed Palmerston's approach to newspapers during his earlier years in Parliament. Although The Times's precedence in London and abroad was clear, the market was sufficiently large to accommodate other papers which could boast a regional or class significance. As he was most adept at leveraging newspapers to his own ends, Palmerston's long shadow over British media was palpable. David Brown perceived that Palmerston did frequently frame his public discussions of foreign policy in terms of national honour, such as would resonate with a wide audience. This strategy could both distract from domestic issues and reinforce national pride, while positioning Palmerston as the statesman, perhaps the only statesman, who could defend British interests and put British honour first. Palmerston also recognised the capacity of the press for stoking angst, patriotism and xenophobia during periods of crisis or perceived decline, cultivating a profile as the defender of British prestige. With this influence, Palmerston was well placed to advise his contacts to use the rhetoric of honour in their pieces, and though his success may be debated, it certainly amplified his parliamentary message. Palmerston's control was not absolute. As his famed quip explained, he could impel but not control, but he nonetheless constructed an invaluable web of sympathetic editors and reporters by dispensing bribery, flattery and patronage, wielding more control than his contemporaries over the press, and occasionally drawing their ire for it. Palmerston's death did not mean the end of this strategy, nor did it signal the obsolescence of national honour. When writing to an ambassador on Austrian tensions with Prussia in 1866, Foreign Secretary the Earl of Clarendon discerned that Austria will face war rather than the humiliation which Prussia seeks to inflict upon her, and in adopting that course I think she is exactly right. Clarendon justified Vienna's stance on the basis that a disastrous war is better than voluntary disgrace. This reflected contemporary views of how national honour worked. No self-respecting nation could submit to impossible demands, but it was equally impossible for Britain to intervene in the Austro-Prussian struggle. John Russell explained that it would be an injustice to the people of England to get involved in a quarrel in which neither English honour nor English interests are involved. These views were also presented and debated in the media. A significant example may be taken from an 1871 discussion hosted in the Pall Mall Gazette. There, France's apparently hopeless struggle against Germany was seen in the context of national honour. The debate began thanks to the contributions of leading social and political commentator William Rathbone Gregg, who insisted that the French government should have conceded defeat earlier, and that national honour could not be damaged, since Emperor Napoleon III, rather than the French nation, was truly at fault. Gregg's interpretation was bitterly contested just 24 hours later. Then, in an official reply titled For Honour's Sake, the Pall Mall Gazette mounted a spirited defence of national honour, while worrying that the ethic had somewhat declined in importance, and warning, present comfort may be purchased with dishonour, but dishonour has its own penalties, and they have a tendency to accumulate and are generally irremediable. Gray's response challenged the Gazette's interpretation of honour, prioritising a sense of duty. Gregg contended that to fight to the end out of fear of what others would think of you was a false point of honour, and that there was no shame in defeat. Gregg did reassure readers, I suppose I should fight as resolutely in defence of the national honour as most men, and probably without calculating very closely the chances of success. Yet his point was that commentators had mistaken the point of honour, because he could see no sense, no virtue, no notion of duty, no courage even, but mere criminal and childish folly in bringing prolonged misery and ultimately worse evils on the country, merely that bystanders may clap their hands over our pluck. In that same issue, the Gazette advised, it is so important that false and misleading notions of national honour should be rebuked and right and true notions established that we take leave to answer the remarks made on that subject by William Rathbone Gregg in another page. The Gazette did this by focusing on honour's gendered nature, supposing that instead of illustrating the obligations of national honour by the personal honour of a man, we take the personal honour of a woman. This was more than fair, since there is greater likeness between the honour of a nation and of a woman. The Gazette argued that the lady's proper course, according to William Rathbone Gregg, would be to decline a contest with the superior forces which have already hurled her to the earth. Yet, clearly, a woman who, in the case we imagine, abandons all care for what her husband and sons may think and decides whether she shall quietly surrender or not upon a judicious calculation of forces, does ill and not well. Extreme though this example was, the Gazette equated this resistance to a duty, likening it to the behaviour of nations. The Saturday Review offered its own perspective on this debate, presenting honour as the reward for moral conduct, while defending its general record. Honour, the review argued, was an important step towards morality, had a civilising effect, and was vital among nations where the question of law had not been as developed as among individuals. Indeed, the review upheld that in a society like the Society of Nations, in which force is the ultimate appeal, honour in the sense of reputation, especially the reputation of courage, is of more importance than it is in the case of individuals. Needless pugnacity it did not recommend, but a readiness to fight was a duty for nations, and this sense of duty is much more likely to have a practical influence on men's minds if it be put forth under the guise of honour. The review declared that it cannot fairly quarrel with the appeal to honour so long as it is not perverted to sanction any course which would not be prescribed by duty as well as honour. In the case of France, whose struggle appeared doomed, the review prescribed that surrender was not dishonourable, but that a certain degree of resistance was required first. By contrast, the woman's duty was more fatalistic and could afford no such surrender. Following the Pall Mall Gazette's response that day, this public debate over what national honour required came to an end. The commonality between the statesman's private rejection of disgrace and the Gazette's public emphasis on fatalistic resistance in the name of honour could only reinforce the standards of the ethic among Britons. This leads to another question: the extent to which British newspapers merely educated its readers or actively influenced their views and values. This important debate has been considered further and was interrogated by contemporaries. Brown argued that statesmen had more control over newspapers than initially believed, and that Palmerston's example was not atypical for a ruling class eager for opportunities to spread their political message. The media could also pursue societal agendas disconnected from foreign policy. It has been contended that printed illustrations influenced British impressions of Ireland, engendering a sense of racial superiority. Similarly, the press was instrumental in crafting the iconography of John Bull, the personification of the British Empire in the 19th century. Hannah Barker has shown that the media could exert considerable domestic pressure when it adopted causes such as Catholic emancipation, the Great Reform Bill, repeal, and the abolition of the Corn Laws. Such sources exerted a like influence in moments of foreign crisis, capturing the imagination of anxious readers in the process. Considering this, it is no surprise that the Earl of Aberdeen co-opted the Times during his quest to pacify the Oregon question. Following his intercession, the Times ceased its previously bombastic talk of national honour, presenting the issue instead as a matter of compromise, honourable to all. In terms of political biases, some newspapers, such as The Times, Morning Post, and Morning Chronicle, adapted their message as their editors changed. Others, such as the Manchester Guardian, London Evening Standard, or Globe, adhered to a largely consistent line on foreign policy. It may be argued that the fortunes of these newspapers changed alongside their political leanings. Although The Times dominated the media landscape, the depth of the London newspaper press alone meant Britons had several options and thus several opportunities to engage with the rhetoric of national honour. In the main, Whig and Liberal papers tended to be more vocal on the subject, occasionally supplemented by radical sources, while Tory papers, at least until Disraeli's premiership, were more restrained. This could be explained by the cooperation between Whig papers and Palmerston, which identified the party with the rhetoric of national honour, even if some of his colleagues were uncomfortable with this prospect. The partnership was a lucrative one. The Morning Chronicle was considered a rival to the Times in the 1830s before changing editors and supporting Peel's Conservatives in the following decade. Thanks to Palmerston's relationship with The Globe, that paper enjoyed heavy representation on the continent during the same period. The Morning Post, once an opponent of Palmerston, effectively supplanted the Chronicle as his mouthpiece by the 1840s, thereafter enjoying a resurgence. By 1880, one perceives a general shift in tone, facilitated both by Disraeli's transformation of the Conservative Party, encapsulated in his embrace of prestige, and Gladstone's simultaneous pursuit of a more pacific, moralising liberalism. Despite the changing political times, the rhetoric of national honour remained a constant fixture of the press. Where such rhetoric did change, it amalgamated the ideas of imperialism, prestige, and jingoism. This represented a wider shift in British consciousness and Europe generally towards the developing world. Though it will be demonstrated that confrontation with non-European powers frequently provoked the rhetoric of honour, from the 1880s this rhetoric became more anxious as British imperial interests expanded. Henceforth, it would be easier for Britons to relate the rhetoric of national honour to their country's expanding interests. But newspaper editors faced the same problems as the statesmen. Namely, the efficiency of their rhetoric was subject to the circumstances of the crisis itself. When confronted by a straightforward foreign incident, such as the Trent Affair, contemporary papers were united and defiant. Yet, when matters became complex, such as during the Schleswig-Holstein crisis 3 years later, it was tacitly recognised that readers were less amenable to mobilisation over such a confusing subject which did not directly impact their lives. What emerges is the slippery concept of public opinion and its maturation in Victorian society. This question of public opinion, the quest to control it, and the fruits of this process have also been addressed, albeit in limited scenarios. The historiography of Victorian print media, in short, is comprehensive and expanding, yet an analysis of national honour in these sources has not been provided. This research project lacks the space to provide a definitive account of national honour in Victorian newspapers, but a substantive survey of their comments and conclusions, inclusive of regional and London sources, represents a useful first step towards a proper explication of the ethic in the public record. This exercise begins in the first chapter of this research project, where the record of Whig foreign policy in the 1830s is analysed, and the rhetoric of national honour is comprehensively assessed. This concludes the introduction of the thesis, history friend, so I hope by now you understand why national honour was so important during the period, and how I intend to approach such a complex, multi-layered subject. Clearly, national honour was more influential than its occasional appearance in war declarations might suggest. It was connected to a nation's military power, to its ability to pay debts, to the reaction to insults, and to the slow acceptance of practices like arbitration. Something which clearly contributed to this influence was the press, who attempted, with varying degrees of success, to present their message to the public. This message, if effective enough, could increase sales, so there was an incentive to embrace the language of national honour and its trappings, appealing to patriotic Britons in the process. It may never be entirely clear whether the press embraced national honour because it was popular, or whether national honour was popular because the press embraced it so enthusiastically. It's the whole chicken and egg thing all over again, really. As we've seen, though, opinions varied depending on circumstances and the inclinations of the newspaper in question, whether national honour was or was not at stake. The message was harder to deliver in complex situations. Britons preferred a straightforward case of right versus wrong, of an insult received by an insolent power who needed to be taught a lesson. As these tactics were developing in the backdrop of an incredible surge in newspaper activity and reach, questions like how newspapers presented or discussed national honour in their pages are really important. Papers like The Times could have an outsized influence on public opinion, and like the aforementioned puzzle on national honour, it was not entirely clear whether the press actually shaped public opinion or whether public opinion influenced the position which newspapers adopted. It may have surprised you to see just how underrepresented national honour is in the historiography. You may have expected some hidden cache of material where historians many decades ago set forth all they believed to be true about this fascinating belief system. That at least was my expectation and then my fear. The whole point of a thesis is to deliver an original piece of research, and it was literally impossible for me to do otherwise so long as I stuck with national honour. Although personal honour has received some attention, the sheer scale of the possibilities national honour throws up, and this is speaking only in the British case, really suggests that when this gap is addressed, we'll be closer to understanding the beliefs and behaviours of 19th century contemporaries better than ever before. It's simply reductionist to point to the money in these situations. While tangible interests were powerful motives, we should never discount the ideological, nor should we write off as insincere the professed belief in national honour simply because contemporaries were willing to use these beliefs to their advantage. I hope it's now clear why I focused on the rhetoric during this thesis. By addressing the language or lexicon of honour, we can discover how incredibly deep national honour was. Thereafter, we can see how contemporaries linked this language to their behaviour. The true extent of the synonyms used is striking. That contemporaries could allude to national honour without mentioning it by name, that they could refer to its foundational principles while bringing forward another element of it, and that all of this would be accepted says a lot about rhetoric in the 19th century. Of course, it wasn't just politicians on their soapboxes, it was also earnest newspaper editors who sought to criticise or support a political figure or decision. Ideas like prestige, credit, influence, dignity, respect, good faith and standing were useful synonyms which reminded one of national honour, yet provided a more specific focus. Prestige and standing could refer to military power, credit to the ability to pay off debt, good faith and dignity to the respectful norms of diplomatic relations. Contemporaries appreciated that these terms were synonyms of the national honour, just as they were symptoms of national health. When circumstances called for a more precise argument, these synonyms could be used to make a clearer case. Interestingly, these synonyms were perceived as important enough in themselves to motivate statesmen towards some striking policy decisions. Much like national honour itself, though, the context of a given crisis was central to how successful the use of national honour's rhetoric would be. As we'll see in the first chapter of the thesis, national honour was affected as much by the failure to discharge one's debts as it was by the failure to uphold obligations to allies. The 1830s was a turbulent time for British foreign policy, yet it was mostly politically stable at home. The Whig Party served an almost unbroken tenure in office from late 1830 to the arrival of Sir Robert Peel 11 years later. It was a remarkable political period, arguably dominated by the newly minted Foreign Secretary, Palmerston. Palmerston's regard for national honour and his ability to use it in his speeches particularly distinguished him as something of an expert, an impression which only increased when it became plain that Palmerston didn't merely wish to speak, he also knew how to be heard, by co-opting the support of several newspapers and shaping the narrative that the public received. Such tactics were by no means brand new, but no statesman before Palmerston had made such effective use of them. Certainly no statesman had combined the flair for national honour with such a wide platform. His would be an example which others attempted to emulate. But in the next installment of this series, we'll see how Palmerston cut his teeth in foreign policy with the aid of national honour. I hope you'll join me for that. But until next time, my name is Zach. Thank you so much for listening and supporting this show, and I'll be seeing you all soon.